Hello, and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith, and today we have with us performance artist Corey Smith.
Hello.
I'm going to interrupt you because I'm just that excited. First of all, your last name is Smith, which is a bomb last name.
It is,
yeah. My last name is Smith. Second of all...
Do you know a lot of Smiths?
I know probably too many Smiths.
Well... My mom's maiden name was Smith.
Really?
Both of your parents' last names are and were Smith. And, like, in fact, we haven't talked about this on the show, but both of our grandparents are, we both have a grandpa, Richard Smith.
Oh.
And a weird joke, like, was that it was the same guy. And so we did a thing where we were like, all right, you pull up a photo of your grandpa. I'm going to pull up a photo of my grandpa, and then on the count of three, we're going to show each other our grandpas.
Oh my gosh. That sounds like a very stressful interaction.
Yes.
Par for the course.
It was before we started dating, though, so it was low impact.
That's good. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I think that's one of the prerequisites, I think, is to make sure your relatives.
Make sure that check your relatives.
Yeah, you did the work, you got it out of the way.
Absolutely,
we did
it.
Okay, cool.
We did it early. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
No, I'm just really excited to talk about your work, and I kind of want to give some background on kind of how we ran into each other, just because I think it's fun. So you sent us press information about your show back in like November.
Yes.
Or
yeah.
Something, and I remember. We were getting, so I think that we had like put out a call for writers and stuff like that. And so we were getting just a bunch of emails and I was like changing jobs at the time and your email came and I was like, I definitely need to reach out to this guy. Cause it stood out to me.
Cause oh, wow.
At the bottom of it, you were like, also, I like your stuff. Like, it's really cool. And I was like, okay, I gotta reach out to this guy because he sent me his press release, but then like wrote a little note at the bottom, which is awesome. But then it got to be literally yesterday. I was like, oh God, I hope I didn't miss his show. And I saw it was this weekend and I emailed you and I was like, I am so sorry. Do you have any time this week? And now we're here.
Oh, That's very sweet of you. No, I really respect the hustle that you guys are doing. So it's that is very meaningful.
No, it's like part of the hustle, I think, is the fact that like we're doing it, and because we're so focused on it, it's kind of inconsequential if people are paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that people are paying attention, it almost seems like, why are they paying attention? All I'm doing is just working. And so, yeah. But it's like, it's always cool to, like, I don't know.
To have a chance to check back in on that.
Yeah.
That's kind of a really beautiful, sort of ego-less way of approaching it. That's mm-hmm. actually quite lovely.
Well, we try, you know, to be not shitty, I guess.
Well, not shitty, but
I think that's something that like we've talked about a lot, which is the idea that like ego isn't inherently bad. Like some people, like, it's just a difference of personality almost to a certain extent. What?
No, because I've just got like a really big ego.
Yeah.
That's fair. Well, I mean, so the Buddhist in me says that the removal of ego is in fact the primary goal of existence, uh-huh. right? Is to supersede that.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, I mean, there's a really wonderful parallel in art making of like, once you let go of being afraid of what other people think, then you can like really do profound work. And it sounds like you're sort of there, at least with this project.
So I think
that's the key is compartmentalizing the projects and the ego. Yeah.
I think that I went, the fact that we have a podcast though, I think couldn't exist if my ego wasn't so big.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, I'm like, my viewpoint is so valuable. Everyone should hear it.
Here's 180 episodes of it.
Of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
But enough about me. I'd love to talk about what you're working on because it is so, so cool.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I'll just give you this the spiel real quick. So this weekend, January 12 through 14 at Lynx Hall, we are premiering my performance, which is called The New Prairie School. It's a work of experimental theater, which sort of combines theater and performance art and dance and music into one big, messy whole. The piece takes its inspiration from the work of Frank Lloyd Wright, which is like the great American architect. And when people mention Wright and when they talk about Wright's work, they talk about a couple of things. Like one is that he was like this like very daring radical. He's like this wonderful artist thinker. And then the second thing that they always mention, right, is the prairie style of his architecture. That there were these buildings that he built, primarily in the Midwest, although all over the States and in Japan and in Europe, that were sort of inspired by the North American continent, the great lost American prairie. And I like that. I like the fact that like there's this like connection between like radicalism and modernism and these new daring thoughts and Midwesternness.
Yeah.
And so the piece is sort of a working through of that, talking about architecture, talking about my approach and my thoughts about the Midwest. There's also a lot of dancing, singing. I'm joined by two amazing collaborators, Claire Sachs and Ethan T. Parcell, who are my backup dancers and my my musicians behind me, as well as co-performers and just like really incredible, wonderful presences.
Stellar. Okay, so I have a weird first question for you. It's normally actually my like question that I ask like towards the end of an interview if I'm like I need a question to ask, but I feel it's actually really relevant to this to this conversation, which is it's also weirdly a theme for the show, which is the idea of what Chicago means for you as an artistic space. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's always an interesting question, but I think that for this specifically, it's super interesting because you've kind of touched on a couple things that I think run central to that theme, which is like how like fertile the ground is for radicalization. I think that's true very much in Chicago's political history and in its artistic history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But also I think that there's a lot of room for messy experiences, as you put it. And so I'm your answer to this question doesn't have to include those things. It just made me, I sometimes I'm a bad journalist and don't get to the question right away because I like the ideas that, anyway. The thing that I want to ask you, though, is, like, for you, what has Chicago, what has, what has this meant for this process, it being, you know, not in a coastal city. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a coastal city, but you know what I mean?
The Third Coast, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is both the question of my life right now.
Yeah.
So it's terrifying to answer, but also it's the most invigorating question I could possibly think to be asked. So thank you. I think that Chicago is a wonderful place in a lot of different ways, but I was just thinking about that this afternoon, is the fact that we don't have, or we have very few celebrities who live in Chicago, despite the fact that we're the third biggest city in the country. And so it's, you know, it's like, whenever I'm in New York, you like walk on the sidewalk in Manhattan and you see someone, you're like, oh, that's John Hodgman, right? Like, it's like there's this thing of there's a lot of very famous people, but in Chicago, that's less so the case, right? I thought I saw Chance the Rapper the other day, but I don't think I did.
That's like the closest thing to Chicago. Like, I may have seen Chance the Rapper.
Right.
I don't know.
Like, Barack Obama's not coming back. He's like not here.
And if he did, imagine the traffic.
Right, it would be a whole disaster, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Poor Hyde Park.
So I think that there's something very, and I feel difficult choosing my words here, but there's something very sort of working class about Chicago. I mean, it has that reputation already.
Yeah.
And there's something very, very humble about Chicago. And I think that is a really interesting and compelling thing for a city to have.
Mm-hmm.
There are a host of problems that come with that.
Right.
And there are a host of things that I want to talk about in the piece. And obviously that's a generalization, but I think that that is a really valuable thing about this place that's one thing that I really love. There's a legacy here of experimentalism, but the experimentalism is strange, and it's not mm-hmm. like other forms of American experimentalism, like the Chicago Imagists, right? We're like surrealists, but not,
mm-hmm.
or like Goat Island, which is this like performance art company in the 90s. We're very big in Europe and had a lot of trouble getting traction over here, because
mm-hmm.
Their work just like was strange and didn't resonate as much as it should have, because it was profound.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like very weird, and I love that.
I agree, and I think it's interesting because we kind of get, you know, I think when we think about figures that are, like, on a national scale, it is that very, it can go into that very LA, New York mindset very quick, but, like, people that live in Chicago, like, they interplay both of these influences, and on top of that, like, the things, I just totally forgot what I was going to say.
I have 10,000 questions if you want me to jump in.
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so I am holding several documents in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually holding only half of the documents that are involved. Half. But one of them is actually really speaking to me, and it is a bound book of pictures where on the left page there are photos of the coast of Lake Michigan, and on the right page there are photos of a prairie, and I would love for, I have my own opinions about it being from the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
and I'm born and raised in Milwaukee.
Hey.
And so I like the fact that there's on one hand the lake and on the other hand flat rural land, mm-hmm. like very deeply speaks to me.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Like I was looking through this and just like getting feels, because I was like, yeah, that's what it is. but I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to kind of that dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, absolutely. So one of the central motifs of this work, of this performance that's happening this weekend, but also just my work over the past 4 years or so, is the connection of horizons between the Great Lakes and the rural Midwest, the prairie, or just generally flat land. I think it's a really interesting symbolic unifier between what you might consider the upper Midwest and the Great Plains, which are all lumped together in the U.S. Census as the Midwest. And so if you try to find a line between Iowa and Michigan, it's that. It's the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very profound to put those two things next to each other, and I think it creates... My hope is that it creates this sense of ecology, this sense of dialogue between those two places.
Yeah, that is super interesting to me. From the perspective of like something that we do is kind of in a similar vein, and it's something that I'm finding in. It reminds me a lot too of A People's History of Chicago, which is a book of poetry, which is this idea of taking something that can be read as so not artistic, meaning history or journalism or ecology and geography of lakes,
mm-hmm.
and making it a very artistic experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of curious for you, because that seems to, and first off, if I'm making an assumption about your work, let me know. But it's that seems to be kind of a backbone of it is the Great Lakes and the but specifically these kind of very, like, I'm looking at your thing and this almost gives me like a brutalism vibe of like the like, because these are like public domain looking kind of like, they look just like they're made by the city almost. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious for you, as a person who has an artistic background, when your source material is so reliant on something that can be seen as so unartistic, where what's been your You know, and I don't mean to like try and box you into an idea of like what is the through line of your project, but but like what has been the kind of guiding forces in that way? Like from where did you go? Because was that the starting point? Kind of this like was it lakes first, or was there a different kind of first? Like, or did it all just kind of come together at once? Mm-hmm. Is that a weird question?
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Real quick for the folks at home, the documents we're referring to
are
a book that I'm putting together for this performance that is coming out through Matchbooks Press, which is a small art books press in the city of Chicago. Cool. The book is it's a collection of research images and it's the script for the show. It comes in 5 different parts. It's not one collectively bound book. And so it has a lot of different elements playing around. But to get to your question, what came first? It was always the lakes. I grew up in southeastern Michigan, just across the border from Toledo, Ohio. Yeah. The distance from my childhood home to Lake Erie is about a 10-minute drive. Lake Erie is a very special place and is a very complicated place, because it is the shallowest and most polluted of the Great Lakes.
Oh.
It's having the most difficulty environmentally. And like, there's algal blooms happening, and when the algal blooms happen in Lake Erie, you can't drink the tap water in Toledo, which includes the water system, includes my childhood home. Mm-hmm. So it's always been the Great Lakes for me. And I would say the beginning of this project actually came from a moment of connection when I spent a month in Iowa on a farm at an artist residency, and I drove out from Toledo, took just I-80 west, and to Grinnell, Iowa. And I had never driven that far west. I think the farthest west I'd ever driven was Chicago.
Okay.
I'd like flown to San Francisco before, but this was the first time like going into, you know, the plains,
right?
Yeah.
And I had this idea, like, growing up in Michigan, you sort of get the thought that like Nebraska and North Dakota and South Dakota are all one giant empty wasteland, which I think is sort of the feeling that like a lot of the country gets.
It's the same feeling in Wisconsin.
Oh, totally. Yeah,
absolutely. Where we're like, what is even in Iowa?
Right.
Like, what is even there?
Absolutely. You think like, oh gosh, it's nothing. But actually driving out was this just profoundly a moving experience of just like the beauty of the rolling hills of Iowa. It's like not flat at all.
It's beautiful.
And it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. But it made me think of the Great Lakes. It made me think of home. And it was this moment of connection of like, oh wait, okay, there are things that connect this place that I'm staying in, mm-hmm. and the place that I grew up, and the place that I went to college, and the place that I'm living now. Like all of these places, there are lines between them. And I had learned that these places were separate. I had learned that they were antagonistic.
Well, it's so interesting to me, like, so that what made, you know, what carved out the Great Lakes and what made the eastern Midwest so flat were glaciers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through the neglect of those glaciers on the western part of the Midwest that left the area untouched. So, like, in terms of Wisconsin, it's pretty much cut in half between being very flat and being very hilly. Certainly mm-hmm. not mountainous, mm-hmm. but hilly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting that, like, that there's just this huge shift, like this visible shift
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
from something so massive as a glacier.
Oh my gosh. It's, yes.
And, like, and I love the Midwest. I love the Midwest. I love it so much.
It's an amazing place, and I think that part of this piece might have started from sort of a feeling of inadequacy, a feeling of like, of, you know what, well, like, screw New York, right? Like, we have great things here. This is beautiful. All of you guys are liars.
Yeah.
And it evolved out of that. I think, like, that's a very untenable position. I think that it's very mean-spirited, and it comes from a defensive place and not a generative place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, New York is great. Don't get me wrong. Who doesn't love New England, right? Like, all of these places are beautiful. But I think it is also important to, like, very much appreciate what we have, which is a beautiful home that is complicated and dense and incredible in all sorts of different ways. And paying attention to that is very important and something that I didn't do for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so this piece, I think, is sometimes sort of just a mea culpa to the region.
Did you at any point leave the Midwest? Like, have you ever lived in not the Midwest?
I haven't, no.
Really?
Yeah, I've always lived here.
That's so, it actually took me leaving mm-hmm. to appreciate it mm. because I went to college in Baltimore. Mm. And so I was gone for 4 years. And when I graduated college, there was a 3-month stretch where I was like, I'm going to live in Baltimore. Mm. And then I couldn't handle, like, I wasn't ready to be independent yet. So I moved home. And I reluctantly moved back home. But I then, like, lived with my mom for 3 years in Milwaukee. And then just grew, like, as an adult, I, like, saw the Midwest with new eyes. Mm. I was like, oh, like, it's this beautiful place with amazing people, and it's a blank slate. Mm. Not a blank slate, but, like, it doesn't have all of the, like, been there, done that artistic energy mm. that the East Coast has. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's a freshness about it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I will say that I think that is, like, another special thing about the Midwest arts community is that, I mean, maybe it's just because there's not as much money in it, but it does seem, like, much more collaborative. It seems much more like we're all in this together. If you're doing good work, like, good on you. This is amazing. I'm going to try to help you as much as
I
can.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's really hard to, because this is something that with this conversation and kind of, like, related to this, something you were mentioning about it is, I just think a lot about, like, how do we get the work that's going on in Chicago onto a national scale? Not that it needs to do that. I'm not saying that needs to be a thing that happens. But it's just, you know, when you think about, like, that was where I just remember what I was going to say earlier, which is, like, we think a lot about the idea of there are artists and, you know, famous people, I guess you could say, that did make their start in Chicago. And we kind of think of that second to, I mean, you know, like the folks that came out of, like, Second City, obviously we, like, recognize that Second City is a thing, but even then I still think that there's kind of like there's a disconnect to a certain extent that Chicago is the thing that makes that. And it, like, Kanye West is a great example too, where it's like people don't think of, I mean, when he first came out they thought of Chicago when they thought of Kanye West, but not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
Whenever I have conversations with my relatives about Chicago, because my family is all from Chicago.
Yeah.
And most of my family lives in, like, the Chicago suburbs, and, like, my grandma lives out by, like, Rockford. But but, like, it's amazing, like, talking to my relatives about, like, hip-hop and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, well, Kanye West is from Chicago. And they're like, really? And I'm like, you live 45 minutes from Chicago and you don't know that Kanye West is from Chicago?
Really?
It's like, and that's, oh my God. And that's what's so...
That was a Moody, oh my God.
Yeah, Moody just jumped up on my lap very cutely. And it's this disconnect that, like, as soon as people leave, they, like, leave Chicago behind them. Mm-hmm. Like, almost aggressive. Aggressively so.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
I think, like, there's something that speaks to, which has been something I've been mulling over since I started this piece, has been the fact that the Midwest as a region sort of lacks a mythology. And this is, like, this is one point where, like, New York, like, really kills it, right? Like, New York, the city, is a self-sustaining, like, mythological machine. Like, all it does is generate stuff about itself.
Right.
And it just only serves to just kind of hype itself up. That's maybe mean-spirited to say that, but, like...
No. I actually think that's very intuitive. Because, like, that is something that I think Chicago lacks, which is the ability to celebrate itself.
Absolutely, yes. And, like, and that extends, I mean, all over the region. If you think, like, the prime example for this to me is Prince, who lived in the Twin Cities area for his entire life.
Again, a thing you would never think of unless you, like, actually looked it up or something. You know what I mean?
Right, absolutely.
You would just assume he lived in a weird house in L.A.
Right.
Yeah. No.
I think people from Twin Cities know that Prince is from Twin Cities.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Not even from. He lived there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's like...
Yes.
It's all there.
Yeah.
But, like, but we would never think... Like, if I said, name a Midwestern musical artist, Prince would be so low on that list.
Right, oh, yes.
Like, maybe you'd get Motown, right? Maybe you'd get Motown. Maybe you'd get, like,
See,
Chance.
See, that didn't even occur to me.
But, like, yeah, all of these things.
You might get Bon Iver.
Oh, yeah, totally, Bon Iver. Although, like, I feel like he is just, like, so Brooklyn-y.
I think it might be because I'm from Wisconsin that I'm, like, that... and he has this festival that he holds in Western Wisconsin every year called the Eau Claire Festival. But in my mind, the sound is very rural Wisconsin to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only because I have an association with that area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. I will say that he is definitely is doing wonderful work. Justin Vernon is doing terrific work and is just so supportive of Wisconsin as a place.
I know.
It's like amazing.
It's hard to be supportive of Wisconsin as a place right now, though. I will say that.
It has a tremendous, like, all it takes is just, like, a little bit of a glance at the history and the wonderful things that have come out of Wisconsin, and, like, oh, man. Oh.
I know you're just, because you're a wealth of, every time we go to Wisconsin, all of a sudden she's telling me more about the socialist history of Wisconsin.
Oh my gosh, Eugene Debs, like, right? Like, yeah. It's all there.
Oh, yeah. No, I love Wisconsin. I love Wisconsin so much. No, I like... yeah. Speaking of... I want to move on to a different aspect. Okay, there are two avenues I want to... Because there are two
this
possible...
This is like such a scoppy moment right now.
There are two possible prongs. Because we were talking about social... Okay. I want to very quickly touch on an aspect of your show that I absolutely love.
Great.
Is the sliding scale ticket prices.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And I thought of that because we were talking about socialism. So you have a sliding scale ticket price based on income.
Yes.
Which is the best thing I have ever heard. Because, honestly, it makes sense. It makes total sense. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the fact is, if you... It's about... You know, being able to go see a show is about... I want to say priorities.
Yeah.
But it's how you manage your money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like if two people come to the end of the week and they're looking at possible shows and they're looking at how much money is left over,
mm-hmm.
and two different people are going to have two different budgets.
Absolutely.
But the fact is, you're allowing those two people to see the same show.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is incredible.
Mm-hmm. It's very important to me that art. That the work that I do remains affordable, but also that being affordable does not mean that everyone gets charged $5 to get in.
Mm-hmm.
That it is like it is very much capitalism is screwed up and distributes money unevenly and distributes wealth unevenly, and like the job that I currently have, I work at Northwestern University and I make $18.36 an hour. Is a desk job, and it's very easy, and I go and I sit at the desk. Maybe easy is the wrong word, but it's not strenuous. I don't feel stressed by my job.
Mm-hmm.
When I first moved here, I worked at Whole Foods and I made $10 an hour, and I lost more years off of my life because of that. Because it was stressful. It was like this like retail environment, and I was like working behind the food counter, and I was very, very, very tired at the end of the day. I put in so much effort into mm-hmm. that job. And it totally does not make sense to me that that pay scales are so uneven like that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it, like because there's the one level of like where when you see kind of artistic institutions wanting to be like, oh, we should be more accessible, but then they don't think about that at all. Like especially when you start thinking about like. Cultural, like how the like different neighborhoods of Chicago are so deeply segregated, and like how like working class conditions are so varied, dependent on like that like the person's experiences and like what kind of job they're having, they can get, and like how like single. I'm just thinking of like single mothers that like have kids that are working like two part-time jobs, and it's like and obviously that's one experience, but then if you're going to even go to the level of like where like if you're assuming that like those folks are not going to afford your show, like even there are artistic folks that like would go to the show that can't afford it because of just that same. There are stratifications in every way, and I think that like the idea that like making these experiences to that they're like we don't consider how varied these experiences are is like such a crime.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, I go on podcasts and I quote Marx, right?
Good for you.
Right, it's like the Marxist thought of like to each according to his own ability and yes. and to each according to their own need. Like when it comes down to it, if a single parent of two kids wants to see my show, right, I want them to be able to see my show.
Right.
And my like the income stratifications that I have listed on Ticketfly sort of accommodate that, but not entirely, right? Mm-hmm. If that single parent is making 50K a year, obviously that's very different than if I were making 50K a year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So like the stratifications only help so much, but they start the conversation at least. And I think that's very important. And it's like, yeah, it's a matter of both valuing artists' time and also valuing the idea that these things should be more equitable, that they should be distributed in a more equitable way.
So is this based on like an honor system?
Yes. Yeah. So it's all self-reported.
Yeah.
The trickiest bit I think is going to be at the door. I'm not taking money at the door. Links Hall is providing a volunteer. And so I feel equipped to have this conversation, but I know that society has dictated it so that this is a very uncomfortable conversation to have.
Yeah.
And so I'm preparing some materials of like, this is a suggested donation if you make this much money, but it's pay what you can. Please do not feel afraid to pay $1, and please do not feel afraid to pay $30. Like, that is important.
Cool.
We'll see if it works.
I'm very interested. I'm very, very interested. Well, because, and I think that, I think that is, there's a certain level of, if you give a menu of options like that, I think that some people will believe that the worst in people and believe that people on an individual basis won't see the merit of the work that you're doing, you know? And I think that, I guess I just don't believe in humanity that little. Like, I believe that humanity will do it. I mean, you hope that, at least, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other thing is too, another factor that I'm not publicizing because it's not super important to me to publicize it, but it is important for my own sense of morality is maybe the wrong word, but 20% of all proceeds will be donated, and half of those, so 10% goes to the Great Lakes Alliance, and half of those go to the Flint Center for Childhood Development. I think, but you know, it's important to me that if I'm going to be attempting to like tell a Midwestern story, like credit where credit is due, those people are doing the real work.
Yeah.
Like the people cleaning up Lake Erie and the people like serving the children of Flint, Michigan,
right.
Like they deserve money. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so 20% of every ticket sale goes there. And so I also don't feel bad asking people to pay money.
No, you shouldn't. And I think that hits on a really interesting note, is that because of the fact that, like, in a certain way, the, like, populations around the Great Lakes are neglected because of the fact that we're afraid to, like, regionize it for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, that's something that was so... But it makes way more sense because, like, in that, what you're saying, like, Erie's on the... Flint's not in Erie, right? Flint's on Michigan, right?
No, Flint is in the middle of the state. It's the middle of the state, yeah.
But they get their water from Lake Michigan, don't they? Or that was the whole...
From the Detroit River was where they originally got it, and they switched to the Flint River, which the Detroit River, it goes from Lake St. Clair into Lake Erie. So it's, like, connected. It's all... Right. I mean, it's all the same watershed.
Well, the issue... Michigan has a troubled history with water anyway, because So growing up, we had family friends who lived in Niles, Michigan, and they weren't able to drink the tap water. And they lived on the eastern coast of Lake Michigan.
Mm.
And we lived on the western coast of Lake Michigan, and we could drink the tap water, but they could not.
Mm.
So Michigan generally just has water issues, which is shocking because it is... surrounded by water.
It has the biggest coastline of any U.S. state. Yeah.
Well, I always think of, and I remember when we were in New York, I like was talking to my dad about this, that New York has like one of the most, and I'm actually now looking up the map because I want Erie's on New York, right?
Lake Ontario is the lake that sits up.
That, thank you, sorry. But my point being here is that like New York touts itself as having like the greatest water of all time. Like, but like New York is very much a part of that Great Lakes system.
Mm-hmm.
At least Western New York is. And so I think the fact that like there's the aqueducts that feed like the cleanest water in America to New York City are like billions of dollars of like infrastructure that like purely works on gravity, that like gets all its water from like the Catskill watersheds, like in upper New York State. And it's like this gorgeous, glorious system of water that's like centuries old and is and then a state over. You know, or like two states over, or like within the same lake system that New York State inhabits, like there are people going without clean water.
Yes, yeah, it is. It's kind of astonishing. Or it's not kind of astonishing. It is astonishing, and it's astonishing that what is the it's either the second or third. I can't remember. I think it's the third largest freshwater system in the world is the Great Lakes. And we are doing a very poor job of taking care of them. I guess we could be doing worse. So there's that.
Yeah.
But the system is out of balance right now. Mm. Ooh, Koyaanisqatsi. There are a host of invasive species that are posing very, very serious problems and are causing these sort of like feedback loops that result in algae in Lake Erie, right? Mm. It's like zebra mussels are eating all of the small things, which then none of the big fish can eat. And so then this algae proliferates and there's nothing to eat the algae, and then the algae blooms and then it's poisonous to drink. And when you boil the water, it doesn't actually make it go away. It makes it worse. So it's an awful system, and it's a feedback loop. And we're stuck inside of it until we find a way out.
Yeah. So this is great. This is not great. That's not great. But what I'm coming to though is realizing that me trying to form my next question is also very much part of my next question, which is like, as we're talking about all of this and kind of something that I touched on earlier, but I just kind of want to like figure out from your perspective, because clearly you're able to create a prolific amount of work from that, like what is the transfer of this turning to art, what is that moment, how does that happen for you?
Absolutely. This is sort of a bold claim to say, but maybe like art making is about making bold decisions. So I don't know. I'm not going to qualify it. I think it goes to the thing that I mentioned earlier about the Midwest not having mythology. Mm. I think part of the role of artists is to provide that. I think that part of the role of artists is to question and provoke, but also to create narrative where there wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to do a thing that Frank Lloyd Wright attempted to do, right? Which is like take the notion of a Midwestern landscape and turn it into a thing. Mm. And in Wright's case, it became very, very celebrated, and it became this kind of like legacy and very exciting component of architectural history and American architectural history. I don't know if like if we'll get that far with my performance art piece, it's to take like, okay, we have really great horizons here in the Midwest. What would it mean to make horizon music, right?
Mm.
What would it mean to like take that and be like, this is a Midwestern horizon, and let me perform that for you, and let's all like have that experience, and hopefully with the goal that it creates just a little bit more of a mythology around it, that maybe the next time an audience member, or even just myself, goes to the lake, like can consider the specialness of that for just a split second longer.
Yeah, when I lived in Baltimore, one of my favorite things to do was to drive with, like, bring a friend home with me to Wisconsin,
uh-huh.
And the drive from Baltimore to Milwaukee, you go through Maryland, you cut through Pennsylvania, and then you take I-80 through Ohio and Indiana,
yeah,
through Chicago, up through southeastern Wisconsin to Milwaukee. So you see this, you see the country transform. And one of my favorite things to do was when we were driving through Ohio was, you know, on your right side you have fields, on your left side you have fields. And I, one of my favorite things to do was to say, hey, look to your right, guess how many miles that is.
For real. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. That is like, that's really it. In fact, there was this like, oh, I'm gonna forget the thing now. There was this this understanding when white settlers were first coming west and hit the Midwest, it was like it was the West, right? It was this kind of like scary territory. And two things happened that I think are really fascinating is like, one, the concept of prairie madness came about, this notion that like people would be in these homesteads on the prairie and then lose their minds because they just were looking at emptiness all day. And again, like the Buddhist in me says like, oh, cool. That is like, that's interesting. That's like, that's proto John Cage, right? But then the second thing is like, for a while that the Great American Prairie, this like big open space, was something to see. It was like very exciting. Oh, yeah. To come out and be like, wow, this is like, there's not a mountain in the way. You really can see the whole way. Like, who knows how far that is? And it's going to take us like a day to just like travel through all of this tall grass. Which is just wild. I think that is like, that's an incredible thing.
Absolutely. I'd love to talk more about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of a Midwest hero.
Yes. Yeah.
In our conversation of like, who are the Midwestern celebrities? I think that Frank Lloyd Wright is definitely one of them. And it's to the point where like, you only hear about kind of his like troubledness. You only hear about that when you're older. Because I grew up, like, when I was in high school, we took a field trip out to Taliesin out in Spring Green.
Wow, yeah.
Which was so cool.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, I have a very vivid memory of, like, walking through this, like, path, and there was, like, there were no trees, so the sun was just, like, beating down on us. And we were walking through, like, this tall grass, and there was, like, wild rhubarb growing along the path.
Oh, wow.
And I, like, picked a thing of rhubarb, and like, my friends, like, dared me to just, like, bite into it, and so I did, and it was sour and horrible, but like, but it was like, it was such, I was walking and I was like, this is like the most prairie thing I have ever experienced. And like, of course he built like his architecture school there, like out in this like nothingness. It was amazing. So I just want to hear you talk about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Sure. Yeah. I mean Frank Lloyd Wright, I feel very complicated towards him at this point in my life, and maybe it's just because I've spent too much time thinking about him. You're so right in that, like, he was, I mean, he's considered the first, like, starchitect, right? He's considered the first person whose, like, personality was bigger than his buildings.
Yeah.
Literally. And his buildings were pretty big, right? So, like, there are a lot of them, and they're very celebrated.
Absolutely.
So, like, I feel so ambivalent towards Frank Lloyd Wright, the person. I think he was kind of, he was not very nice.
He hung out with like Ayn Rand.
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah. Ayn Rand would like come out to Spring Green and like hang out. She like had a room at Taliesin.
That's like not great.
No. She's a dumpster fire.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, and like, and just the way that he talks about his buildings is often just like, just very pretentious, and like, I was trying to read his books, they're just like full of nonsense.
And they're, and all of his buildings, there's like a principle with Wright's structures that they're all just like shoddily built.
Yes, they don't work as buildings.
No.
Like, the roofs are always leaky.
Yeah.
And like, it never, the Roby House is currently going under renovations just like because it can't make it through that much time.
Well, and it was built like 100 years ago.
Yes, but like, there are totally houses that were built 100 years ago that are still working.
My mom's house was built 100 years ago and it's killing it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Like, maybe you need to replace a window every once in a while, but yeah, like,
then you're good. Yeah, I think she's got a roof replaced, but like, mm-hmm. who doesn't need their roof replaced?
Well, that's why I love brutalist architecture. I'm like, I've been getting really into it because I'm on the internet in 2018.
God. I do like the brutalism is like coming back. That it feels is great. Really
coming back. Like, it's people are really into seeing structural supports. Like, it's
oh
yeah,
and concrete.
Mm. Yeah, but I even just the theory behind it of like actually getting to see how things work, I think is kind of where we're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're
mm-hmm.
like, I think we've been for so long not seeing how things are made, except for like food.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, right. But yeah, you imagine that like most contemporary skyscrapers are like sexy new buildings that are mostly glass. Like, the whole point of the glass is to trick your eye. It's to make yeah. you think like, oh, there's not a support there.
Right.
Right. That the whole building is floating. And there is something very grounding about the brutalist approach of like, here you go.
This is it. This yep. is how this building works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But like, but I suppose more to the point of Wright, with all of that being said, with a big caveat that like, he was not a nice person and thought of himself as this great man. And I'm just like, so not about that. And I'm not here to perpetuate his myth. Like, I'm just not interested in doing that. That being said, I think he was a good artist. Like, I think his buildings are good.
Mm-hmm.
Are they the best? Probably not. Are they very good? Yes. Does his approach to architecture like pose some interesting questions? Yes. I love that. Like, if anything, like, these ideas that he accidentally stumbled upon are profound, right? This notion of organic architecture, the idea that like you can build a building, or the correct way to build a building is into the land and not just on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the idea that's going to save the world, right? Oh, like yeah. that is like local food production. That's like, be a member of your community.
Didn't mm-hmm. he like build houses around existing trees?
Ooh, I don't know.
I, for some reason, because I went on a Frank Lloyd Wright stint.
Mm.
Like, I think after, when I was a teenager, after I went to Spring Green, I, like, wanted to go down to Oak Park and, like, see.
Yeah.
And I went around that whole Frank Lloyd Wright neighborhood, and, like, I read some books and stuff like that. And for some reason, that's sticking out of my mind, but that could also be somebody else.
I guess he had a ginkgo tree in his studio.
Oh.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Mm.
And there are a lot of pictures. I'm getting now pictures with trees and houses, but now I don't know.
Ginkgo leaves are a big part of his aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my mom is really into Frank Lloyd Wright,
mm.
and for in my childhood, there was a pattern of ginkgo leaves that lined our dining room.
Wow!
Because she really liked ginkgo leaves because Aww. Of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Oh
yeah, his studio. When it was added in 1898, he built an interior passageway around a beloved willow tree and allowed it to grow into the house.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Dropping knowledge.
Oh, cool.
I mean, Google is currently dropping knowledge. Shout out Google.
What? I was the one who brought it up.
Yeah, that's fair.
Google's just the conduit.
Yeah. Oh. Google's just the site.
Yeah.
The citation, rather.
Yeah.
Mm. But I think that To get to the heart of that is a really interesting approach to place based art making.
For sure.
Art making that emerges from like literally the land that it sits upon, and like celebrates and tries to reinforce the things about the land that it sits on.
Mm-hmm.
And that as an idea, I mean, has just like so much like resonance today.
Mm-hmm.
And has so much to offer, I think. And so that in particular, I feel like is the real thing that I'm here for, right? I'm like, his houses are interesting, and they're very interesting as metaphor for performance. Like, what does it mean to hide a door, right? Because you can never find the door in his buildings. It's always off to the side. So like, if you were to take a performance and hide the door to the performance, what would that mean?
Yeah.
Right? What would it mean for all the rooms to be the same room? Like, are there transitions in that piece? Like, are there... when you're experiencing time, like, how does that work? Also, this like his decorative eye is like, it's like straight out of Beethoven. It's this like idea of motivic development, where he just like reinforces the same shapes over and over again, and they slowly change as you move around.
Mm.
Like, those are very like provocative prompts for performance.
Yeah.
And that's very helpful.
If the room, if all the rooms are the same room, like, does the piece start?
Yeah. Yes. Does it end? One presumes that, like, at some point you do exit the house. So, like, I guess so. Yeah. Yeah, it's like that. That feels like it's just like such an exciting idea.
That I'm glad you just said the one of the things that is still resonating with me that you said probably about 5 minutes ago was the idea that Frank Lloyd Wright stumbled on a bunch of ideas. But like that is like such a perfect and in a day and age where we're so constantly like and a great reason, like picking apart like the like mostly white male cis like brilliant minds of culture in the last few
and, like,
centuries.
Picking apart process and
mm-hmm. Well and realizing that so many people are like so intensely problematic. Like there's kind of a resurgence of being like fuck Wagner because like fuck Wagner. But because
he's
like anti-Semitic and but my point being is that you can do that and also it's something that I hope we figure out like a like way to signify like they had a powerful brain, but like what does that mean? And like does that mean that like not in the sense of like it's a quantity not a quality? Does that make sense? Maybe I don't know. I'm sitting here trying to pontificate on what the words for what I'm trying to say is, which is that like someone can have made interesting art but then also be not a person to like look up to or to like venerate or to like
put
on a podium.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, right now is the perfect time to be thinking about that because there are so many art makers right now, specifically men, mm-hmm. who are turning out to be abusers, who are turning out to be terrible to women. And
well, and so to that point, like I think of the perfect example for this for me is I always think of Woody Allen and I always think of Manhattan, the movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like the way that he interplayed like such a classic like the him setting the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue over like the skyline of New York City is like one of those iconic mythology creating moments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very good. It does its job so well.
Yeah, but I also like at a certain point you can go like, oh yes, like it takes a powerful brain to do that, but there's also not much that is inherently Woody Allen. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's like no actual intellectual property there. There's nothing where you go like, oh, because of Woody Allen's experiences, that's why he... Mm-hmm. I mean, short of living in New York City and having heard Gershwin before. Like, I think that that's a really interesting...
Well, for me, what resonates really deeply with me, and it could be that I enjoyed his comedy, but for me, in this whole uncovering and, like, calling out of toxic masculinity, specifically in the performing arts, the mainstream performing arts, the one that has really stuck with me was Louis C.K.
Oh, yeah. That's
because I have anxiety issues, and when I was dealing at the height of my anxiety issues, one of the things that would kind of bring me down was watching stand-up comedy. Mm. And I would watch Louis C.K. because it was just kind of like, whatever. And so, like, I was like, I get you, man, like, you and me. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden it was like, JK, he's a horrible man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do we reconcile it? I don't know. I mean,
Well, because you can say till the end of time that, like, art and artists are different, you know, but...
I also don't want to, like, to, like, superimpose this, like, film of men are terrible... Oh. And like blah 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 over this piece. That's not my intention.
I'll absolutely take that. That's a 100% fine thing to superimpose over this piece.
Okay. No, I mean,
kind, Corey.
We're like having a conversation about Hollywood and blah blah blah.
No, but I mean, it feels very relevant, and it feels like a profound question, and it gets down to this like this thing that like art making is a social practice. Mm-hmm. And like to make art just like in any way, either you're doing it for yourself alone or you're doing it for other people, and if you involve other people then suddenly like there's moral questions. Mm-hmm. This is like, you're so right, like we can say to the end of time that you have to separate art and artist, and like maybe you do and have to in order to like operate. But also there is this fundamental thing of like Frank Lloyd Wright was a dick, And like, how do we deal with that? Mm-hmm. How do we deal with the fact that like I've had a good experience with this building?
And we and humanity loves cults of personality.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
We love latching on to, oh, we can put a name, a person's name to a feeling that we have. Like, that's amazing. Anyway, yeah, we're actually like a little over. Which is
really?
Which is a shame for like that we the last bit we've kind of left on isn't entirely about. Well, Frank Lloyd Wright actually.
Well, like I'm sorry to go over a little more, but
no,
I'm like,
no,
I'm going to give you like another thing that I've been thinking about, which is that like it's just the inherent problem of mythology, which is like as I said earlier, like, I feel like one of the roles of an artist is to produce a mythology. I think the other thing about mythologies is that they're inherently false and that they inherently trick us and are sort of unsustainable ideas. And a great example of that is exactly what we've been talking about, which is like how great the Midwest is, and it's wonderful. And it is a wonderful, beautiful place that I care about very deeply, but it is also profoundly hurt, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, there are profoundly messed up things that happen here. And like, segregation is more intense in the Midwest than it is in any other spot in the country. And like, there's a reason that Ferguson is in Missouri, right? Mm-hmm. And there's like a reason that the South Side of Chicago and like is like so segregated from the North Side and the West Side. And like, there is a profound American pain that exists here in a very unique and distilled way. And so like, while I do think a goal of this piece is to provide a positive mythology for the Midwest, it's also about acknowledging the fact that like there are problems, and we have to confront those. I mean, like Michigan and Wisconsin, like went for Trump, right? Yeah. And like, what do you do with that? What do you do with that? Like, we have to like realize that that's like a real thing, that this exists, this divide and this hurt exists within our home. Yeah, sorry to jump on that for like a second, but I think
it's fantastic.
It feels very important to say.
Absolutely. No, and I mean, I think that throughout we've touched on that, like you love the Great Lakes, but the fact is for parts of your childhood, you couldn't drink the water because of the lake. And you know, it's earlier I was like, it's hard to love Wisconsin right now, but like at the same time, like you love Lake Erie.
Oh my gosh.
That's not your Wisconsin. Fault or the lake's fault or Wisconsin's fault. You know what I mean? Like it's,
But those, like those systems play out in very specific ways here and have profound influence.
Yeah.
Well, okay. We have a few minutes left. The last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1 minute plug for anything they have upcoming. Sometimes it's very obvious, like a performance art series, but we also love hearing about other folks that you think are doing dope work that deserve a shout out, and just general self-care things, movies, TV shows, books, music, anything that you're just kind of consuming that you want to share.
Right on. Okay. All right. Here's my go. One, come see my show. It's the New Prairie School, premieres Friday, January 12th, until January 14, 7 p.m. each night, sliding scale, ticket price. Two wonderful, wonderful performance groups that you should go see are Hot Kitchen, which is an experimental theater collective that I think has a show with Rhino Fest coming up. Cool. Like every Monday in February, something like that. It's amazing. You should go see it.
Cool.
Two is Mock Rep, which is a new music experimental performance ensemble that do amazing work. And I don't know what their next thing is, but it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And then three, if what you have heard today is interesting at all, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes is a wonderful book that like profiles the problems that are present. Also, Critical Regionalism by Douglas Reichardt Powell, who's a professor at Columbia College, talks about regionalism and how we might be able to activate regionalism for a more progressive perspective, to like use it to advocate for a more equitable society.
Wow.
That is amazing. I need to buy that book.
It's great. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are so many ways that you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our articles, podcasts, videos, everything, you name it. It's all there. There are a few different sections on the site. There's a news section, objective, local arts, and local politics, as well as an opinion section where we have a few different columns. We have our newest column in there is called Milk and Petals, is from our friend Caitlin Ruby Miller, who is a photographer, photographing.
There we go. We got there.
Photographing. just a few different folks that she's worked with, mostly singers, but also models, and also a lot of different artists doing different
things
of work, dancers.
Stuff like that.
And for her work, for the most part, and I think in totality, is like kind of understanding and verbalizing the feminine experience. Is that a fair word?
I'd say so. She's looking to photograph women of all looks and all experiences, and basically demonstrate that there is beauty to be found in every person who identifies as female.
Cool.
Yeah.
So check all that out. You can also keep up with our podcast under Scoppy. You can keep up with us on social media. Sorry, on Facebook that's Scoppy Magazine, on Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Google Play. Radio Public and iTunes Podcasts, that is Scoppy Mag, and we spell that Scapimag.
And as always, I'm here to emphasize the importance of donations. We run on a shoestring budget. Everything that we've been able to do up to this point has been through your generosity. So first of all, thank you so much. Second of all, we could use a little bit more help. If you're in a position to give, you can head to our website, scoppymag.com, and go to our donate section. There are a couple ways that you can give. First of all, you can do a one-time donation. If you choose to do that, you will have our eternal gratitude. If otherwise, you can support our mission of uplifting local arts and independent media for as little as $5 a month. If you're interested in giving in a higher level or in advertising opportunities throughout all of our content, feel free to reach out to us at scoppymag@gmail.com. So, give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.